This week's Pseudopod is brought to you by Infected by Scott Sigler. Something has infected Perry Dorsey. Something hungry. Something intelligent. Something with a plan. By the time you hear the voices, it's already too late. Pseudopod 82, March 21st, 2008. This week's story, The Language of Crows by Mary E. Chu. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from Mary E. Chu. Mary's work has appeared in The Window of Dreams, Starline, and Dreams and Nightmares, as well as other venues. Your narrator this week is the word whore of Air Out My Shorts, the podcast that puts the shots back in short fiction. There's nothing like Air Out My Shorts out there, and the word whore is one of the best-voiced, smartest, funniest people working in podcasting. But in the meantime, lock the doors, because the crows are starting to roost, and I have a story for you that I promise you is true.
The Language of Crows by Mary E. Chu. I've told Min a thousand times not to feed the damn birds. Rubbing a clear spot in the grimy pane, I watch her from the upstairs hall window as she tramps around the front yard. Her soiled dress clings to her, and wisps of her mousy hair drift about her head. I can see the end of her long, sharp nose as she turns this way and that, scattering crumbs and whatever else is on that revolting platter she's carrying. She's indulging the crows today, though she knows how much I hate them. Min keeps the garden immaculate, like some sort of shrine for the birds. She's supposed to maintain the house, too, but you'd never know it. The place is a pigsty. Like her, it needs a bloody good scrubbing from top to bottom. My hand tightens around the bottle of medication. I can hear a plaintive sound, then a sliding, clacking crackle. It's Jeremy's pet crow, Fidel, calling approval from his cage by the front hall window downstairs. There's a flock of crows in the yard now, squabbling, shifting their glossy wings as they close in on the feast. Min's murmuring and cooing at them. Min's Jeremy's cousin, and they've always been close. If it wasn't for that, I'd throw her out on the... A soft moan from down the hall claims my attention. Of course, I forget myself. Coming, I call out, though I know Jeremy probably doesn't hear. The floorboards squeak as I move. It's a terrible old house. Pokey little rooms and a narrow, difficult staircase. I can just see Fidel past the stairwell. He cocks his head, studying me with a malevolent, glittering eye. Jeremy's passionately fond of him, and I'd swear the bloody bird takes advantage. I push the door to the bedroom wide, approaching the bed. Jeremy's worse today. It's hard to believe he's the man I married 3 years ago. His illness has taken a terrible toll. I pour a spoonful of morphine and brace his head and shoulders while he takes it. Pills are too difficult for him to swallow now. I can hear Fidel squawking from the hallway below and the screen door closing. Min has come inside.
Susan?
Jeremy's eyes struggle to find me. His voice is coarse, beleaguered.
I must know how everything...
Jeremy, love, everything's fine, I interject. Min's round and about. Fidel has been fed, and Edward is coming today with the papers you wanted. Edward, Jeremy's solicitor, has been back and forth with his secretary a lot lately regarding Jeremy's will. Edward did tell me last time that he's getting concerned in view of Jeremy's extreme medication and state of mind. Most of the estate and the house go to me, but, well, after. I'd rather not stay. Jeremy seems satisfied with my explanation, either that or the medicine's taking hold, as his eyes glaze over and his lids close. When I leave him, his breathing is shallow and even. Fidel eyes me stonily as I tramp downstairs, my shoulders knotted with tension. I glare back at him. I didn't mind him that much when Jeremy and I first married and I came here. But with what's happening now? Fidel seems to be watching. No, almost enjoying what's going on. I stopped hauling the cage into Jeremy's bedroom for visits when the doctor objected.
Besides, Fidel appeared to relish Jeremy's distress, his head cocked in curiosity and expectation with every moan of pain. A small boy is coming up the front steps. It's Raleigh, a neighbor's child. Imaginative, charming, he's my one delight these days. We talk and play games often. "Mrs.," he says through the screen, the perennial question in his blue eyes. "Later," I promise. "If you're quiet, we'll play ball out back." Raleigh smiles his radiant smile. He's a bittersweet reminder that I'll never have Jeremy's child. My fingers contact his through the screen, and his little leather bracelet slips down his wrist. Then he's gone, running down the path. Min is in the kitchen, washing dishes with a grubby cloth and water that looks and smells like day-old tea. "You're such a young, pretty thing, with those green eyes," she says after a moment, making no effort to hide the spite in her voice. "Pity you have to go through all this." Jeremy's the one to be pitied. "Some things are meant," she replies, turning to stare at me with her colorless eyes. I'm furious at the platitude. "Min, for God's sake, change the dishwater and get a decent cloth and rinse off the hard bits in the soap." She's supposed to help. That's why Jeremy asked her to come here when he came back from the hospital. He thought he'd recover, but I knew better. Gritting my teeth, I bundle the garbage into one bag and struggle outside to the back. I'm angry to find that Min has made a scrap pile by the garbage bins, likely for the birds. I glance up and around to see crows on the ridge of the roof, the chimney, all eyeing me.
"Wish you'd do something about that."
The voice of our neighbor at the fence startles me. He's part of a contingent that's taken up residence in the luxury homes that have gone up in the area. He frowns, indicating the scrap pile. "Mr. Russell's a good sort, really, and I can't blame him. I'm sure Min's violating some bylaw, and anyway, scraps can attract rodents. The Russell's house is some distance from ours, but still." "Sorry," I mumble. "It's Min. I'll get rid of it." His face softens. I don't think he likes Min any more than I do.
"Damn crows."
He looks up at our house.
"They're all over. Even my air rifle doesn't bother them much. Neighbors have been complaining about them lately. We're thinking of approaching council." "How's Jerry?"
he adds. "Fair," I muster a smile. He looks uncomfortable.
"Give him my regards."
Mr. Russell waves and retreats, defeated by what he sees in my face. On the way back to the house, I'm aware of sudden movement above, of a rolling shadow and a fluttering sound. I squint against the sunlight. A huge crow is hovering directly over me. I move on, and he follows, almost lazily, keeping himself between me and the light. I begin to run, but he maintains a precise distance between us. Suddenly he swoops, and there's a stabbing sensation at my temple. I swat him away and rush through the back doorway, slamming the screen shut. The crow retreats to the trees, and the others gather about him. A muted cackling starts up among them, as though they're discussing some maneuver. There's a report that can only come from Mr. Russell's gun, and they scatter. Min's been after Russell a lot about that. Blood trickles from my temple. "Small Raleigh down the road's gone missing," Min says, handing me a towel that's more or less clean. She looks almost pleased. She makes no comment about the crow and gets annoyed when I fetch a bottle of peroxide and begin cleaning my wound. "How can that be, Min? I just saw him." I'm shaken by the attack, scarcely paying attention. A loud cawing from Fidel distracts me. I look through the kitchen doorway and down the hall. Edward, Jeremy's solicitor, is at the front screen, briefcase in hand.
"Edward, if Raleigh is missing, I should help look for him," I protest, holding the towel to my head.
We're sitting by Jeremy's bedside, waiting for him to waken. My rickety chair creaks every time I move, as I glance out the window at the Russells and the other splendid houses nearby. I make the inevitable comparison before I dismiss it as unworthy.
Everything looked normal on the street when I came in. We'll ask Minerva about it later. This is important, Susan.
Edward taps his briefcase. Besides, I don't like what happened with that damn bird.
Edward needed an explanation. He's a reassuring person, the kind that seems to have no doubts about himself or the world. He and I were going together when he introduced me to Jerry. They were longtime friends. There was no animosity when I broke it off, and we've remained close.
You know, Edward, I say softly, the crows reigned supreme around here before the developers bulldozed so many wild areas. I think they talk to each other, as if they have some strange kind of language. It's like they're discussing, judging me.
Jeremy stirs, opening his eyes. He struggles to sit up, and I reach over to help him, plumping the pillows. His breath sounds like wind blowing through reeds.
Ed, he says with a ghastly smile. Something twists inside me. That smile, once so beautiful, had first won me over to him. Now it's a travesty, more like a grimace.
I think it's time, especially as your strength is so limited just now, Edward says pointedly. Puzzled, I look from one man to the other. Edward opens his briefcase and takes out a long document, and as I glance at it, I realize it's Jeremy's will.
Susan, I insisted we explain to you, Edward begins.
Jeremy fumbles for and finds my hand. His fingers are so cold. I want to wrap him in a myriad of blankets to keep what's left of him warm. Edward drones on, and as I listen, chill realization creeps in. There are a few extra things, bequests, a trust for a distant cousin. While he talks, Edward hands me a list of Jeremy's assets, and I'm amazed to find out how wealthy my husband is. I was a practicing accountant before we married, but even so, it takes a moment for me to absorb it all. There are recent changes which are, in a word, bizarre. The house is still mine, provided that I don't try to sell it or his other properties. Part of Jeremy's fortune will go to maintaining them. The rest is split between Min and me. We'll both be well off. The catch is, I get nothing if I violate any part of the bequest. Min gets to stay. So does Fidel. I feel like a guilty child, reprimanded for taking what isn't mine. Jeremy knows I don't like Min. Before he got so ill, we used to joke about it. He's certainly aware of my feelings for Fidel, though I keep them as much to myself as I can. Jeremy was always a little eccentric. Now, my husband presses my hand with tentative strength. He looks at me, appealing. For a moment, painfully, I see the old Jeremy.
Promise me you'll keep the house. Set up place in the lot for the birds.
I'm not sure what he means, but I'd do anything to ease his distress. A white lie can't hurt, and I nod.
Take care of Min. Fidel. Promise. I want to see Fidel,
he adds. Then to my relief, sinks back. I nod again. I sense there's more to his plea, something hidden and uneasy. Edward has set aside other changes Jeremy wanted. I glance at them, taking in some request about setting up a bird sanctuary, then thrust the papers away, too upset to read more. Jeremy is sleeping in that shallow manner I've come to dread. I motion to Edward and we go downstairs. Once in the hall, I can't contain my anger.
Bitch!
My voice startles Fidel, who shifts in his cage. I think back over all the time Min has spent with Jeremy these past months, comforting him, I thought.
She must have planned this, Edward, from the first. I don't begrudge her the money, but the rest, it's impossible, insane. I understand, if I stretch it, about Fidel. But being saddled with the house and her. Jeremy would never have made those demands in his right mind. As for a bird sanctuary, after what happened with that crow,
It's all right,
Edward says quietly, trying to calm me. I'm shaking with shock and rage.
I've no intention of letting it stand. Several people have noticed Min's undue influence on him.
It's true. Our friends said nothing, but most stopped coming around soon after Min arrived, and a few showed their dislike of her openly. I'm very aware of Edward, his solid masculine presence exuding health and confidence. I'm so tired. I lean against him, and before I know it, his arms are around me, and I'm kissing him, the way I used to kiss Jeremy. For a moment, I have the two men confused.
No,
I pull back, ashamed.
Please.
Edward is unabashed. Just know I'm here, Susie, he says. Now, and later, my feelings for you haven't changed.
I clasp my arms around my chest and he leaves, closing the screen quietly. The tears come hot and fast.
Suddenly, I see Min at the end of the hall, standing in the kitchen doorway. Her figure is shadowed, almost spectral, and I realize that she may well have heard, and certainly seen, everything. This time my rage is consummate. I seem to float down the hall, stopping to confront her. I could strike her if I choose.
You! You! You!
I choke.
You may think you've won, Minerva.
I never use her full name, and my tone is savage.
You and your bloody birds. One way or another, when all's said and done, you're all out of here. Do you hear? Gone.
The last word ends in a sob. I stalk back down the hall, past a wary Fidel, into the sitting room, slamming the door. Pacing accomplishes nothing. In fact, it increases my anger and my sense of panic. I had an unprepossessing childhood, with an evasive father and an alcoholic mother. An experience which left me with a passion for order, for control. In Jeremy, at least at first, I found stability and freedom, the delight I'd never had as a child. Now it appears I'm losing it all. The sitting room is small and cluttered, dirty too, though I turned it out last week. Min again, with her filthy habits. Papers cover the small table by the window. Accounts I'd taken in to help pay the bills. When I think of this and how much money Jeremy has, I repress the urge to laugh hysterically. I've been paying for Min, her food, the stuff she feeds the birds, and some of Jeremy's medicine. Bile rises in my throat. I don't want any of the estate now. But if I don't contest it, Min gets far beyond what she deserves, and with the conditions. Well, there's something vile, unnatural about it all. My eyes go to the bookshelves. They stretch from floor to ceiling, and are the only decent furniture in the room. They're crammed with books that Jeremy and I used to read. My vision blurs as I recall our long walks along the shore nearby, often discussing some poem or novel. I can still see his wonderful, craggy face, his high color, as he laughs and slips his arm through mine. The slant of sun is long as I collect myself. I thought I heard a noise a few moments ago, and suddenly it seems important. I yank the door open to find Fidel's cage and stand missing. There are creaks and muffled crow noises from upstairs, followed by a racking, coughing laugh from Jeremy. I race up the steps and across the landing, bursting into Jeremy's room.
Enough!
I keep my voice low, hoping Jeremy, who's lying sideways, won't notice too much. One of his hands is uplifted. He's stroking the side of Fidel's cage, which Min holds, steadying the stand next to his bed.
Enough!
This last, though ferocious, doesn't rise above a whisper. For once, Min, who never responds much to anything I say to her, look startled. Didn't mean any harm. Min backs away, the cage tottering. Jeremy turns dazed eyes to me and speaks, but I can't hear, as in the next moment the cage clatters to the floor.
The hell you didn't! Get that thing out of here!
Matters threaten to turn ugly, as Min, looking more disconcerted than frightened,
stands her ground. Then I see Jeremy has a glass in his other hand, with the dregs of something discoloring the side and bottom. In the next instant, Fidel has opened his cage door and flaps squawking from the room. I yell and gesture at Min, accusing her of all kinds of things. The medicine bottles on Jeremy's bedside table have been moved around. Min slides past me, muttering about finding Fidel, who's cackling in delight and malice somewhere below. In the midst of this, the front doorbell begins a static ringing. After securing Jeremy, I'm off and down the stairs after Min. It's the police on the front porch, rattled, shaking. I open the screen, barely hearing the names of the two officers. They want to know about Raleigh, as he's definitely missing. And it seems I was the last to see him. I don't recall exactly, but it was a lot earlier when he came over, I say. My voice is high-pitched, and I'm breathing hard. The officers stare at me.
A neighbor says you asked the boy in, one of them says.
No. No, that isn't true. Anyway, how could any of them see the front door with all the trees? God, I sound guilty. Why? I had nothing to do with the boy's disappearance. The thought of anything happened to dear little Raleigh makes my heart lurch. Look, I've told you all I can. I finish, cross now, and anxious about Raleigh. My husband is ill. Min comes up behind me. I stand there, agitated, while they question her. In a minute, the police are done, though they glance back at me with suspicion as they leave. I'm about to start in on Min when I see movement down the hall. It's Fidel. He flaps towards us, grazing and reopening my wound, then flies through the open screen door, cawing triumphantly. Damn stupid! I start onto the porch. Unused to flying, Fidel lands halfway down the lawn, hopping and preening, cocking his head at me malevolently. I pause, wary of startling him. Fidel? Birdie? I inch down the steps, and he hops further away. There's a movement among the hollyhocks. A darkish blur streaks across the lawn, pouncing on Fidel. It's Mr. Russell's gray tabby. Pandemonium reigns, with Fidel shrieking and flapping as the cat struggles to gain a secure hold. Fidel is a large crow, and I'm surprised by the cat's audacity. I can't seem to move. In the back of my mind, there's a thought that if I wait just a heartbeat longer... No, I decide. This isn't right. It's cruel. Horrible. It would break Jeremy's heart. I begin to run. Something flashes past me, and in a second, it's the cat who's shrieking in pain, not Fidel. The tabby rolls over on its back, a pair of scissors sticking in its side. I look back to see Min, poised like an Olympic athlete on the porch, her arms still in throwing position. Plainly, she has talents I'd never suspected. Go after Fidel, she commands me. I'm too appalled to argue. There's blood all over the lawn. The demon Fidel is hopping away across the grass, dragging one wing and grousing pathetically. There's a certain gleam in his eye as he turns his head, which tells me it's a bit of an act. I almost catch him as he reaches the fence to the wild vacant lot next door. My hand swoops down to grab him, but he slips through a fence hole. There's no help for it. With one foot on the rail, I swing my leg over the boards. As I come down amidst the thistles on the other side, I see the cat has stopped moving. The crows are perched along the ridge of the roof. Is it me, or are they actually talking? The lot is densely wooded, almost 2 acres, on the opposite side of the Russells. It belongs to Jeremy, and he told me once he'd never sell it. It occurs to me that this is the lot he meant when we were talking about his will. He wants the sanctuary here. Night is bearing down as I press through the brush and bramble. Great old trees tower overhead, and there are heaps of fallen fir and pine needles everywhere. Through the gap on my right, I can just see the shore, then the bay and the peninsula that's divided by the American border. Fidel is warbling spitefully away ahead. He's moving fast for a wounded creature. The colors of wood and brush look strange, but I attribute that to the failing light. The smell of evergreen and earth is intense, measurably different. I'm sweating, feverish, I think, and it comes to me that I should have gone to the hospital after the damned bird attack for a booster shot and checkup. The reopened wound throbs, seems to reach into my skull. Fidel has really made it worse. Birdie, I pant. Shadows press down all about me. Daylight is failing and the air is thick, as if ready for storm. I can't see bloody Fidel anywhere, though I keep hearing him. I must be sick, because his garble sounds like words, and though I think I half understand them, they're not in any tongue I know. My breathing is awful, pneumonic. I glance up to see a full moon climbing behind the trees, and the spaces between look like radiant tunnels of light. Insects fly everywhere on iridescent wings. I stumble and fall to my knees exhausted. I must have backtracked because I can see the lights of our house away in front of me through the trees. Collapsing, I roll on my back in a bed of evergreen needles to catch my breath. I turn my head. There's a child's torn t-shirt crumpled next to me. Beside it is what's left of a small leather bracelet. Raleigh's. I scream and struggle into a sitting position. Fidel, whom moments ago I willed to die, is at my feet, both wings tucked against his body. As he cocks his head at me, his eyes gleam demonic ruby. He clacks his tongue. Too late do I see my peril, their dark, powerful bird shapes silent in the dead branches of a tree above, visible against the moon. As I try to stand, the first of them, their evident leader, swoops. His beak and claws strike me on the head, and I fall. Another bears down on me, and then another, and another. They peck savagely at my face, throat, and hands, then start on the rest of me. They're so strong. A number of them pin me down while the others go to work. Blood runs into my eyes, the scent hot, the taste coppery as it reaches my mouth. I'm making pathetic sounds. Please, sorry about Fidel. Stop, please. They begin to answer me now, and I understand them better. Theirs are the words of warriors, of predators, alien and pitiless and dark. As my body is torn and torn, I realize how much I am losing, and the least of it is control. One last blink before it all goes, and I see Fidel, who led me to this, dancing triumphant among the trees. At some point, I have a sense of being dragged brutally through the woods. When I wake, I don't know my surroundings at first. Countless insects thrum about, some settling on me. Attempts to sit up, to swat at them, are futile. My head and body feel like fire. As my vision clears a little, the moonlight is brilliant, luminous, in a way I've never seen it before. I'm lying beside our garden shed, a shadowed figure standing at my side. Min. I try to talk to her but find no words. My throat feels strange. Then I see she's bundling some of my clothing, badly torn, into a garbage bag. Min. Her name sounds faint when I finally manage to speak. It's all right, Susan. Her tone is soothing, friendly. She shifts the garbage bag to one hand and helps me up. I say helps because standing is a paramount effort. She loops one arm about my head and shoulders and hauls me along. I wonder frantically about Raleigh, what's happened to him. I'm sickened by Min's smell, her grubby clothing. My feet drag at first, then I feel nothing. There are thudding sounds behind us as we move, but I can't see all that well. Min is talking to me, her voice reverberating. We cross the garden and enter the house, and she maneuvers me up the staircase and into Jeremy's room, easing me onto a chair beside him. Hate what you've done, I hiss, steadying myself as something falls away from my face. Hag. God, I despise her. That's all right. Let it all out. Such a young, pretty thing, she says, smiling. Jeremy, Jeremy.
She shakes his shoulder. He's sleeping on his side, facing me. He stirs and struggles up on one elbow. With an effort, Min makes no attempt to ease. He stares at me blankly. Only then do I turn and look into the cracked mirror on the wall. My reaction is extraordinary. I'm beyond panic. I survey the damage, then the changes. I no longer hurt. Though bits of my former self cling to me, a piece of shoulder flesh hangs from my new neck. Most everything else is gone, except a scrap of foot sticking to one claw and a few shreds of clothing. My eyes are still green, which is a bit of an anomaly, and my glossy black head and body, my wings and beak, are quite splendid, really.
Why?
I demand hoarsely. I suspect most of it, but I need to hear what Min has to say.
Oh, shoosh, she says. They'll explain.
She's breathing hard, looking pleased with herself. Jeremy's eyes flicker. He holds out one hand.
You,
he says in a whistling breath. Is it recognition I see in his face, or confusion? I can't bear to think he planned any of this. Surely it was Min and Fidel, deceiving him, dragging him down into their ghastly primeval morass.
Come now, Min says, businesslike.
She brushes away the last of my ravaged flesh and lifts me, struggling from the chair. I protest, but my words sound odd. My memory of them appears strong enough, but my ability to speak seems to be altered. They're waiting. I can see a couple of crow heads peering at me from the open dormer window at the front, the silver landscape bright behind them. Min pushes me through and I scramble for a hold on the roof. The crows are waiting as I pull myself up and cling to the shingles. The two beside me nudge me upward, and though I'm bewildered and frightened, I don't resist. More of them saddle down the roof towards us, eyeing me as they draw alongside. Shifting my weight from wing to wing, flapping, I gradually gain the lower ridge, the one right over Jeremy's window. The crow leader looks across at me as the rest of the clan, that's what they call themselves, begin talking. It seems Jeremy's house and the lot is their last foothold around here. They have plans to preserve the place, and I'm smart, useful. I'm to take part, to help bring in others like me. Still, it's a tenuous beginning. The clan head has a smaller bird under one wing. They say it's Raleigh, and the eyes do look light, perhaps blue, from here. I can tell he's horribly frightened. He's there for my benefit, so I don't get any rebellious ideas. I must find some way to protect, to free him. Min emerges from the house to clean up any telltale remains, then goes back inside. The light is growing and someone is coming up the walk. It's Edward. How splendid he is, how tall and straight. He's a threat, too. He'll ask questions, make trouble. The clan leader croaks at me and tightens his wing around Raleigh, who lets out a pitiful squeak. Time to pull my weight, to recruit. I need to attract Edward. I call out in my soft, novel rasp, but Edward bolts through the front door, slamming it. The house vibrates with his tread on the stairs. It comes to me then. Jeremy is dying. Ignoring the others, I claw my way to the peak of the roof over the window. The pane is just beneath, and I peer down, my breast heaving. Edward has propped up Jeremy and is yelling at Min. Fidel is back in the room in his cage, and Edward tells her to take him away, demanding to know where I am. I see Jeremy breathe, then stop. I feel so very human again for this, the last. Whatever my heart is, it seems ripped from my body, and my pain is hot, physical, absolute. The clan has the sense to let me be, though a few maunder and cackle amongst themselves. I raise my head and take a deep breath.
The unbearably beautiful moon is fading into the brightening sky. It's dawn, and Jeremy loved this time of day. In the language of crows, I slowly start mourning my loss.
In 1979, Lyle Watson put forward the theory of the 100th monkey. The 100th monkey effect, he claimed, was based on observations of macaques on the Japanese island of Kashima. Some of these monkeys learnt to wash sweet potatoes before eating them, and over time, this behaviour was picked up across the younger generations. The crux of it, though, the point where Watson's work for many parts company with accepted and acceptable wisdom, is his claim that researchers following this behaviour noticed that once a critical number of monkeys was reached, once a critical number of monkeys learnt to do this, the behaviour instantly spread to other monkeys on other islands. I wonder how many crows it takes. This month, Pseudopod is being brought to you by Infected, the upcoming novel from Scott Sigler. The story of an unusually small and uniquely deadly alien invasion. It's one part body horror, one part conspiracy thriller, and Mark Scott's first foray into international publishing. If you're a fan of either of those genres, you need this book. It's really that simple. We rely on your stories to keep Pseudopod going. See what I did there? The wily trickster that I am? Seriously, the only content we generate internally are the end caps for stories and the movie reviews. The meat of the podcast, the bread and butter, our raison d'etre to really cram this sentence full of metaphors, are the stories. Which is where you come in. It doesn't matter if you're a published author or you've never set pen to paper before in your life. If you've got something you think would fit Pseudopod, please read our guidelines and send it along. We can't promise we'll publish it, but we can promise it'll be looked at as seriously as every submission. Of course, there is another place that you come in, and that is donations. We rely on them, and by extension, you, to pay our authors, so if you like this story, then please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. All donations are very gratefully received. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod wants to know, how do you shoot the devil in the back? What if you miss?
They tap into your bloodstream like tiny little vampires. They hack into your nervous system like you were a walking computer network built just for them. They flood your body with chemicals that cause fear, paranoia, and psychotic rage. It's a disease that thinks. It's a disease that talks. And if you're lucky, you die before it becomes a disease that walks. On April Fool's Day, experience the horror thriller novel, Infected, the major hardcover release from number one bestselling author, Scott Sigler, creator of the free podcast novels, Earthcore, Ancestor, and Nocturnal. Available April 1st, online and in bookstores everywhere. Free audio chapters of Infected are available at scottsigler.com and infectednovel.com. The disease kills you slowly if the cure doesn't kill you first.